Obama's order was meant to underscore his administration's promise never to torture suspected terrorists in an effort to get information from them. Tom Jelton, NPR News, Washington.
Sales of new single-family homes plunged to a record low in the U.S. in January. The Commerce Department reports home sales dropped more than 10% to an annual rate of 309,000, and prices were down 14% from a year earlier. Meanwhile, factory orders fell for a sixth consecutive month in January, and new claims for unemployment benefits rose while analysts had been expecting a slight drop. The House of Representatives could vote today on legislation designed to help homeowners avoid foreclosures. It would allow bankruptcy courts to lower monthly mortgage payments and reduce both the principal and interest rates on home loans. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Support for programs on WILL comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. This Saturday's wine tasting will feature a little of this and a little of that, with some French, Italian, American, and Argentine wines in the lineup. Information at 337-7704 or online at thecorkscrew.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from RGP Productions, presenting Music with Sunday Brunch from 12:30 to 2 at Luna, a gourmet tapas restaurant in the old train station due north of the MTD terminal off University Avenue. This Sunday, March 1st, featuring Maria and Company with Dorothy Martirano on the violin and Josh Houchins on bass.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking with author Rick Riordan. I think that a lot of people, particularly if you have kids and they are the boys, you will know him as the author of a very popular series of books, fantasy series of books for children, called Percy Jackson and the Olympians. If you're a mystery reader, you might well know him as the author of the Trace Noire mystery series for adults. And in fact, his adult fiction has won him all three of the top national awards in the mystery writing genre, the Edgar, the Anthony, and the Seamus. He's a former English teacher, taught English and history at public and private middle schools in the San Francisco area and also in Texas, where he is now making his home. And he is going to be here in our area on the 9th of March. His visit is sponsored by the Champaign Public Library. He'll also be making some school appearances while he is here. He's giving a talk at the library on March 9th. Now, the tickets for this have all been spoken for, but we are told that before and after his talk, he will be signing books. So if you would like to meet him and have him sign a book, you can stop by the library either between 6 and 6:45 or afterwards between 8 and 8:45 and say hello, and I'm sure that he would be happy to sign a book for you. Here in the meantime, this morning on the program, we'll talk a little bit about his writing, about these characters that he has created, perhaps also talk about things that parents can do to get their children excited about reading. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome also. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana if you'd like to give us a call. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, anyone is certainly welcome to join the conversation. The only thing we ask of callers is just that people try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone who's listening is welcome into the conversation. Well, Rick Riordan, hello.
Good morning, David. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks, and yourself?
Doing well. Great.
Good, good. I'm glad you could talk with us. I don't know how many writers, I know that there are some, but I don't know how many writers write for such a wide audience. That is, they're writing for the adult reader, and they're also writing for young readers.
Right.
I'm sure that perhaps there are challenges to each of those, and to do both, I would think, would be a pretty significant challenge. Is there something, though, where you would say, you know, at the end of the day, no matter who you're writing for, it's really the same, and you've got to deliver, and, you know, so what essentially is the essence of good storytelling, I guess?
Sure. I think that writing for adults and writing for children is more similar than it is different. I think that what kids are looking for in a book, by and large, are the same things that an adult is looking for a good plot, characters that you can care about, maybe a little humor, maybe a little action, a little romance. It's the same general elements of storytelling in both cases. If anything, I think children are harder to please than adults. I think writing for children has made me a much more economical, much more efficient writer because children tend to be more impatient. They want you to get to the point, and they're not going to stay with you if you stray off the path.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose I would imagine that it would be difficult to, when you're writing for children, to pitch it at the right level and not either overwrite and make it go over their heads or write down and have them feel that they're being talked down to. Just to get it at the right level, I would think that might be tough.
It's a very interesting question, and a lot has been said about that, and writers talk a lot about that, because on one hand, you don't want to write down to kids. They hate that. You want to treat them as if they are peers and equals, and they have a good sense of humor and are perfectly capable of understanding a good story. At the same time, you do want to make it accessible for kids, and sometimes what works for adults doesn't necessarily work for kids. And that's one area where I'm glad that I taught middle school for many years before I tried to write for kids. That was very helpful for me in learning to pitch the story at just the right level.
Yeah. I last night only had the time to begin reading The Lightning Thief, which was new to me, and I was really enjoying it, and I think that I could read that at the point where I'm now. I think that I could read that and enjoy it. But particularly, I think if I was 10 years old, I would really have enjoyed it. And I'm sort of sorry that there seems to be much more good writing for children now than there was when I was 10, would have been 46 years ago.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that we're looking at a renaissance in children's literature right now, ushered in no small part thanks to Harry Potter. And I think today, if I were putting together a reading list for my classes, I would have a much easier time than I would have when I had started writing and teaching back, say, 20 years ago. There's a lot of great, great literature out there for kids.
And at the same time, I know from off and on having talked with people who deal a lot with children's literature, I think that they would say, yes, that there's been a great explosion of publishing for children and that there are many good books, but there are also a lot of really bad ones.
Well, that's true. And I think, as with anything, you have to be a careful consumer. And all kids are not the same. What works for a 14-year-old girl may or may not necessarily work for a 10-year-old boy. And not all 10-year-old boys are the same. So you really have to look carefully, and that's where it really pays to have a good librarian or a good bookseller or a good teacher that you know that can recommend some great books that will speak to your child.
Yeah. Maybe we talk a little bit about Trace Navarre, just because he came before Percy did. Mm-hmm. And the story that I have read is that at this point, you were living in San Francisco, had before that lived in Texas, but here you were living in San Francisco, and that you were just missing Texas. So you thought, well, you would sit down and try a mystery and set it in Texas because you were feeling a little nostalgic about Texas. And it turned out that the first book was A Big Red Tequila. It was published in 1997, and it turned out to be a success.
It's true. It was a sort of a funny path that I took to getting published. For years and years growing up in San Antonio, my teachers had told me to write about what I know, and I always hated that because I didn't really think I knew anything, and I didn't want to write about my hometown. But after being away for a while, I came to appreciate it much more, and I came to be nostalgic for it. I forgot the bad things, like how hot it gets during the summer and all of that. And I just remembered the good things, and I decided to try to write a book. And suddenly the old axiom, write about what you know, made sense to me. Mm. And because I felt so strongly about the subject matter, because it really was a love letter to my hometown, I think that's one of the things that made that book successful, whereas before I had just been dabbling with writing and really hadn't gotten anywhere.
So what about that play? What about South Texas do you think particularly makes that a good setting for this genre?
South Texas is a very interesting place. There's a quote that's attributed to O. Henry. It may be apocryphal, but he said there are four cities in the United States that are completely unique. You can be in those places and not mistake them for anywhere else. And he said those cities are San Francisco, New Orleans, Boston and San Antonio. And I don't know that a lot of people would think of San Antonio right away as a city in that list, but it really is. It has a very interesting mix of cultures. It has a very colorful past. It has the Riverwalk. It has the Alamo. It has a lot going for it, and just some very quirky, interesting characters to write about.
One of the things that I think that is so attractive about the mystery form, or maybe interesting about the mystery form, is how malleable it is, in the sense that you can set it, you can have any kind of, almost any kind of character that you want, and quirky characters are encouraged. You can set it any place you want. You could set it any time you want. You could have a Western mystery. You could have a science fiction mystery. You could have a contemporary mystery. You could have one that's set in the Middle Ages. I mean, you could pretty much do almost anything you want with it. And I think that's one of the reasons that people like it, is that you can find something that has a feeling to it, or a particular kind of character that's just something that you resonate with. And so a lot of different people can all be reading mysteries and all be really happy.
That's right. It's a very versatile genre. You can do just about anything with it. And I think the private eye genre, the hard-boiled noir tradition, is a very American tradition, and it's one I've always been strongly attracted to since Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. And I would put the Trace Noir books definitely in that mold. And setting them in Texas, too, it's interesting you should mention the Western. I think there's a lot in common between the Wild West gunslinger and the American private eye. And I sort of see my Texas private eye, Trace Noir, as a combination in some ways. They're both loner characters. They're both characters that are out in a basically lawless society where law has broken down and can't really address the needs of the people, and they're sort of trying to forge their own brand of justice.
It is interesting to me that it seems, I should not claim to have a handle on the entire mystery writing field, but it does seem that particularly within the last, a few decades, there has been a growth in the number of mysteries that are set in the West. Certainly the first example that everybody's going to think of is Tony Hillerman.
Yes.
But since then, many other writers have come along writing Western mysteries.
That's true. And I think this is a part of a tradition of using mystery fiction as a form of travel fiction. I think a lot of people read mysteries for the setting, for the locale, to go to a place that they've never been. We have mysteries set in Boston. We have mysteries set in Alaska. We have many set in the West. Tony Hillerman definitely pioneered that territory. We have James Lee Burke writing about New Orleans and evoking that sense of place so beautifully. And so I think people respond to that. I think in a lot of mysteries, setting becomes its own character. And definitely, I try to do that with San Antonio in my adult mysteries.
Well, let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. His name is Rick Riordan. He is the author of a best-selling series of fantasy novels for children. That's Percy Jackson and the Olympians. Those books have been out now ever since 2005. The first one was The Lightning Thief, and we are told that this year the last book in this series will be published, scheduled, I think, for May. And also, he's the author of the series all about a detective named Trace Noir, starting with Big Red Tequila. That was published in 1997, and the most recent, I believe, is Rebel Island, published in 2007. He's going to be in Champaign-Urbana. He's going to be giving a talk at the Champaign Public Library on March 9th. He'll be also doing some school visits. The tickets for his talk at the library are all gone, but as I mentioned at the outset, he'll be doing a book signing before and after, and I'm sure that anybody who would like to meet him and get him to sign a book would be welcome to stop by and say hello. And of course, here on the program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for people who have not read Trace Noir, tell us a little bit about this character.
Trace Noir is a Texan who doesn't really feel like he belongs in his own home state. He moved away to study English literature, of all things, at UC Berkeley, lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, much like I did, for a number of years, and then found himself coming home again. And I think for anyone who's moved away from home, and then come back home as an adult, I think you can probably relate to his predicament, trying to convince all the people that you grew up with that you really are an adult now, and you have your own identity, and you forged your own career. He comes back and begins doing private eye work back in Texas. So he's both a native and very much an outsider. So he's an English literature guy who has never been able to hold down a job in that field. And he has fallen in to private eye work sort of by default. He is a martial artist. He does Tai Chi, but he uses it for self-defense, which is a kind of a rarity. And he's a quirky, smart-mouth character. Who has a enchilada-eating cat named Robert Johnson and a whole lot of other strange fellows that help him solve mysteries along the way.
We have a caller. I will not make them wait. We'll get them right in. Someone calling on a cell phone who is in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Thank you for having your guest on this morning. Very fascinating listening to what he's saying about his books. I have two unrelated questions, and after I ask them, I'll hang up and listen on the radio. But the first one is sort of, you mentioned Harry Potter series, and I have a granddaughter who started reading those in the second grade. I mean, it was hard for me to imagine a second grader reading an 800-page book. But those books, you know, are rich in vocabulary. They're really good. And has that changed at all the way that you write a book? Has it increased the level at which you write as perhaps kids are becoming more acquainted with things? And the second question is, as far as I know, my granddaughter has not read your series. I'll certainly recommend them to her. But David mentioned how it seems to be boys read them more than girls. And is that true, and why is that? And also, how do Greek Olympians, which you use in your books, how have those worked into your series? And that seems you're using mythological characters and yet adding to them in a way. So I'll hang up and listen on the phone. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, those are great questions. I wonder maybe if, as a way of answering that third question, and I hope that the caller wouldn't mind me directing you in this way, I thought I would ask you, and I know you've told this story a million times already, but it might be interesting for people to hear the story of how it is you came to create Percy in the first place.
Absolutely, because it is an interesting story, and it's one of those cases where truth is sometimes stranger than fiction. I was a middle school teacher for 15 years. I taught 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and during that time, I taught Greek mythology almost every year, either as part of classic civilization or as part of the literature course. I have been a fan of Greek mythology for years, but I had never considered writing for children, much less writing about Greek mythology, until my older son was in elementary school and began struggling with reading. We found out later that he has ADHD, attention deficit disorder, and dyslexia, which explained why he was having so much trouble in school, and particularly with reading. The only thing that really spoke to him the year that he got his diagnosis was Greek mythology. He thought that was a fantastic subject. They were studying it in school. They were dressing up as Greek gods and telling the stories. So I began telling him some of the myths for bedtime stories. And when I ran out, he got very upset, and he said, well, tell me another one, Dad. And I said, well, there really aren't anymore. And he said, well, then why don't you just make one up? And so partly out of desperation and partly to keep him interested in school, I made up off the top of my head this modern-day demigod character, Percy Jackson, who's a 12-year-old kid in New York, and finds out that like Perseus, like Theseus, like Hercules before him, he is half god and half mortal. His father is one of the Olympian gods. And he goes on this adventure to find a missing lightning bolt that's been stolen from Zeus. When I was done with the story, it took me about 3 nights to tell it. My son encouraged me to write it down. I read it to him as a manuscript. I read it to some of my students. And they all encouraged me to get it published. And lo and behold, the next thing I know, I'm a children's author.
And these books, we were talking a little bit earlier about the Trace Navarre books, that was where you started, and those certainly have done well. They've been a success, but these books that we're talking about here, starting with The Lightning Thief, have been an enormous success, far more than and Trace Nivar, and I think that I read that altogether the first four of those books have sold more than 1.5 million copies. Is that right?
They have really taken on a life of their own. They have struck a chord with kids that frankly surprised me. I hoped that they would be well received. I hoped that they would be books that kids would want to read, because as a teacher, that was always my goal. I wanted students to leave my class at the end of the year loving reading. And if I didn't send them out into the world wanting to pick up more books, then I felt as an English teacher I really hadn't done my job. So I hoped that I would be able to craft a book that would appeal to a wide number of kids. But really, I had no idea how well the series would do or how many kids it would energize into reading. So it's been very gratifying.
And I did mention, and you can tell me if this is not quite right, but I think that I did mention, based on what I had read, that I know that there are girls who read and love these books, but that they have been particularly popular with boys. And I don't know if that's because the main character is a boy or there's something that's very boy-like about the books. Maybe you have thought about that.
It's an interesting question, and they are very frequently called books for boys, and I am completely happy to recommend them to boys because as a father of two reluctant reader boys, that is something I'm always on the lookout for, and definitely I try to cater my books to be appealing to boys who might not otherwise want to pick up a book. Having said that, the first time someone asked me if I had meant these as books for boys, I was a little mystified because I have always taught in a co-ed environment. And when I was writing The Lightning Thief, I imagined myself reading the manuscript in front of my class. And so the idea of writing a book that would only appeal to boys or only appeal to girls was sort of a foreign concept to me. I couldn't imagine doing that. I was definitely trying to make a story that would appeal to both genders. And I think, by and large, I've been very successful in that about half of the mail I get does come from girls. So I wouldn't say by any means that it's a boys-only series, but I think that sometimes it's harder to get the boys to read, generally speaking. And I think that has been what struck people about the series.
Yeah. Certainly one of the big stories in publishing, particularly publishing for young readers, in the past, I don't know how many years, decade or two, is Harry Potter. And there's just been nothing else like it. There was nothing else. I don't think there was anything else like it before. And one wonders, will there be anything else, anything like it ever?
Right.
If you think about just how popular the series was, how many books have been sold, how widely read they were. And I think that, as the caller suggests, that some people were just amazed to see their kids or their grandkids or whatever plowing through these books, and they're huge books. They're very long, and I'm sure that they do place some demands on the readers, and I know that there are many adults who have read and enjoyed these books. Do you think that the level at which they are written, do you think, has that had some sort of impact on you, or generally do you think it's had some sort of impact on children's writing?
I can't really say whether it has directly changed the way that I tell stories myself. I can say with certainty that it has changed the receptiveness of the publishing industry to the sort of story that they're willing to take on and they're willing to market. Harry Potter, I think, opened a lot of people's eyes. Before Harry Potter, there was a general belief that no child would ever want to read a book that was longer than, say, 250 or 300 pages. Well, we now know that's clearly not the case. If we look at Harry Potter, if we look at Aragon, if we look at the Twilight series, these are enormous books that are wildly popular. So that has opened up the field for a wider variety of stories, and I do think the caller had a great point about the language. As I said earlier, you don't want to ever make the mistake of talking down to kids. A successful book will treat them as intelligent readers and assume that if they don't know a word, they're going to be able to figure it out from context. So that's very important, that you tell your story in a way that assumes that your reader is able to follow it and will enjoy it.
We are just about at our midpoint. Again, our guest for this hour, Rick Riordan. He's an author, is the author of a very popular series of books for young readers, Percy Jackson and the Olympians. The first of those books was The Lightning Thief, published in 2005. He's also written a mystery series for adults. His detective is a private investigator named Tres Navar. It's set in South Texas. The first of those books is Big Red Tequila. That was published in 1997, and the most recent is Rebel Island. That one was published in 2007. So if you like the sound of either of those, you can head out to the bookstore or to the library. And speaking of the library, he is going to be here giving a talk at the Champaign Public Library on March 9th. And I'm sorry to say that if you don't have a ticket for this already, they're all gone. But we're told by the folks at the library that he'll be signing books before and after the talk. So between 6 and 6:45 and 8 and 8:45 at the library. And I'm sure that if you'd like to stop by, say hello, meet him, have him sign a book, you should feel welcome. And callers are welcome, too, with questions. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to go back to Harry Potter for a moment, I know that at the height of the Harry Potter mania, there were some people, and I think some of them even maybe were children's librarians or children's reading specialists, who had sort of mixed feelings about it in this sense, that everybody was very excited about the idea of children reading and that they just ate these books up, these big, long books, and just couldn't get enough of them. And that so we said, well, that's great. We want children to read. That's fabulous. They're reading. But there was a but, and that was that some people said, but, you know, we think that there are actually even better books than this. So they were reading and we're saying, that's great. But then there were some people who were saying, but, you know, maybe we'd rather they were reading something else. And I wonder what you think about that whole controversy and how you would come down on that. You know, reading is good no matter what, as opposed to, well, yeah, reading is good, but we'd like you to be reading good stuff.
Well, yeah, that opens up a huge can of worms in that, you know, what do we mean by good stuff? And is what one person thinks of good the same as what another person thinks of good? And that's a huge topic. I think that I would side on the side of the kids. I think basically the best arbiters, the best judges of what is a good children's book are children. And I think if it's something that they are reading and something they are enjoying, we need to pay attention to that. We need to trust them, as I said earlier, to be intelligent readers and to be able to rise to a difficult text. At the same time, we need to trust their judgment about the books that they're reading. And I don't think just because something is popular necessarily makes it no good. If it's popular, there may be a reason for it. It may be a well-told story that really gets kids interested in it. And sometimes the books that we, frankly, push on kids in school, they have the effect of turning kids off to reading. And the more difficult the text is sometimes, the more it needs a good teacher to really engage the kids with the text. It's not impossible for kids to like Charles Dickens or Shakespeare or To Kill a Mockingbird or any of those classic texts. They're all wonderful, wonderful texts. But I don't think that we need to, put away the Harry Potter just because somebody doesn't think of it as literature with a capital L. I don't think that's really the first concern that we could have when we look at the numbers of kids who are turned off to reading by the time they're in high school, and the numbers are staggering.
Yeah. Well, one of the other, I'm just curious about what you think about one of the other kind of controversies swirling around in children's literature, or has been, has to do with the subject matter of books, particularly books that are for older children or young adults, you know, whatever it is we call them in the publishing business. And we talked earlier about the fact that there has been a great explosion in children's literature. And this is a segment particularly, I think, that a lot of people would say, we now have a lot of really good books, a good writing for older kids. So I guess that by that, I suppose I'm thinking like middle school and high school children. At the same time, some people have said, you know, one of their issues with a lot of these books is that they deal with very thorny issues, and that the authors have taken on real serious things like, you know, loss of a parent and confusion about sexual identity and all kinds of really serious, heavy, dark stuff.
Sure.
And one argument is that, well, this is within the book, the world of the book, this is a safe environment in which to explore stuff that kids might be thinking about and might be afraid of. And then the other side of that argument is, well, gee, do we really need to be laying all this really dark stuff on kids at all? And so, again, maybe gets back to this idea, well, you know, what's the purpose of the story? And do you feel that you have to, quote unquote, say something with the book?
Right. Well, the subject matter and the appropriateness of subject matter, given the age of the readership, again, this varies widely. I mean, some 13-year-olds can read a book about suicide, and it just doesn't faze them at all. It's something they're completely ready to read about and something they're interested in, and they find it fascinating, and it's not a problem. Others would find that very disturbing. It varies very much from child to child and family to family, and that's why I think it's so important for parents to be active in what their children are reading, just as they should be about what they're watching at the movies or watching on television. And the more that you can engage your children in a dialogue about what they're reading and about subject matter that might be difficult, the better prepared the parents will be to decide, A, is this really something that is appropriate for my children, and B, if it is, how can I talk through this with them so it can be a positive, constructive experience? I think generally kids are pretty well equipped to deal with a lot, sometimes more than we give them credit for. At the same time, I do think that there are books that are more appropriate in the high school library than they are in the middle school library.
I understand your parents were both teachers, is that right?
They were. My mother was a teacher for many, many years. She taught English, she taught art, and my father was a teacher as well.
And was that, I expect that was a big part of your decision also for yourself to become a teacher?
It was. I guess it was in my blood. I knew about teaching. I had grown up around classrooms, and I remember as early as sixth grade, I would sit in the classroom and I would imagine how I would present the lesson as I was in class if I were at the blackboard. So it's very much something I wanted to do. As long as I can remember, I wanted to be a teacher and I wanted to be a writer. And I'm very fortunate that I got to do both.
Was there something in particular that you liked about teaching middle school?
I have always been drawn to middle school, probably because for me personally, it was just such an awful time. I have terrible memories of middle school. It's a time when kids are just going through so much. Everything is in transition, physically, socially, developmentally. Everything is changing. They're between adulthood and childhood. So much is going on. They don't know where they belong. They're listening to their peers. They're listening to their family, and they don't know which way to go. And in a way, I think it's interesting that mythology speaks very strongly to that particular age group, and they love the idea of these demigod heroes, these half-mortal, half-god characters who take on these huge challenges, because I think it's sort of a metaphor for what they're going through. These demigod heroes are like them, caught between two worlds and faced with these epic challenges, and I think every middle schooler feels that way, that every challenge they face is epic.
And that's, I know before now, people, writers and psychologists and all sorts of people have said that the value of stories like this, traditionally the kind of stories that people have told and now new stories that we are creating, is just that. And that for a child, it's not hard to see that the appeal of an empowered child, empowered young person taking on a world that is so much bigger than he or she, you can see why it is that a character like that would appeal.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. It's a way to explore issues in a metaphor, in a safe environment. And I think that there's a lot of truth to that, and that's why a lot of these old myths still resonate thousands and thousands of years after they were first told.
And just sort of to come back to one of the questions that the caller earlier asked, you do indeed introduce all of the familiar characters or maybe not familiar characters if people had never studied Greek mythology from Greek mythology in these books.
Yes, it really does serve as an introduction to Greek mythology. The series is meant to be read even if you have no knowledge or very little knowledge of mythology. You don't really have to know a lot about the Olympian gods and the old myths before you dive into it. My hope is that if a child reads the series, though, they're going to want to go back to the original source material. They're going to want to check out some books from the library. And anecdotally, I've heard this from librarians across the country, that their mythology sections are getting a heavy workout these days, and I'm very happy about that. Because kids have read Percy Jackson and they're curious, well, what was the original story of Medusa? You know, who was Pegasus and where did he come from? And it's a lot of fun to sort of open up that Pandora's box, if you will, for a new generation of kids.
The fifth and final book in the series will be published this year, and in early in May, I think, is what I have. Is that right?
Right. The Last Olympian is the name of the fifth Percy Jackson book. And I knew from the beginning that it would be a five-book series because I wanted Percy to be 16 in the last book, and he started when he was 12. There are other structural reasons for having five-book series. A lot of readers have you know, begged and pleaded, please, can you make it a longer series? And I will, in fact, be doing a new Camp Half-Blood series, Camp Half-Blood being the training ground where all the young demigods learn to be heroes. Mm-hmm. And that'll start probably in a year. So it won't be totally the end for that story. But I did think that Percy needed to have a good, strong ending to his first adventure.
Yeah, I understand, and maybe again this reflects something of all of the consuming interest in Harry Potter, but my understanding is that in knowing that the series is going to end, that there would be a final book, that apparently a lot of people are very worried that Percy Jackson is going to die.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That did become an issue with Harry Potter, and I don't know. Personally, I would feel cheated if I were reading a series and the main character that I'd been following for so many pages and so many years just died at the end of the series. I don't know. I guess you could pull it off, but I'm not sure that you'd have a lot of happy fans if that's the way you resolved it,
yeah.
Especially since Percy is a first-person narrator for me. That would be a little difficult to pull off, and then I died as an ending line. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I became really fond of Patrick O'Brien and his sea stories. They're set in the Napoleonic Wars,
yeah.
And I think that there were 21 of them. And, you know, sadly, although after having a long and good life, Patrick O'Brien passed away, I think, around the time the last book was published.
Right.
And as I was reading that book, actually, the one thing that I kind of, it almost gets me kind of choked up thinking about it, but that I liked about that book was that, in fact, the stories don't end. Then in that last book, they have their adventure, and then the two guys, they sail off.
Mm.
And so I kind of like the idea that they're still out there someplace.
Yeah.
And that I don't know that that was exactly what he had in mind. But I think the idea that that things don't really end, for me, that had some great appeal, at least in particular with that sort of series that I got kind of attached to.
That's a great point. And I think a good book does more than just tell a story. It creates a geography that the reader can inhabit. You want to have enough space within the story that the reader can imagine having their own parallel adventures. You can imagine yourself as a sailor on one of those ships. You can imagine yourself as a young demigod at Camp Half-Blood having your own adventures. That's very important, and that really makes the book become the readers.
Yeah. I was reading, actually, going back to talking about Trace Nafar, an interview that you gave with somebody who had a mystery bookstore. They have a website. They have interviews with all kinds of mystery writers. And you were talking about Trace Nafar and said that for you, maybe the character is a what-if version of yourself. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, if your life had taken different sorts of paths, that might be you, or you might be something like that. That made me think, particularly for people who do write mysteries, whether part of the impulse is to create alter egos and create an alternative world and an alternative identity for yourself and to be able to place yourself in it.
Right, right. Someone once said that a writer cannot create a character who is not in some part himself or herself. which is a kind of a scary thought if you're writing about murderers and such. But putting that aside, I think there is a lot of wish fulfillment when you have a protagonist. Certainly, Trace Noir, for me, is the guy I might have been had my life taken another path. I wouldn't want to be him because I'm a lot happier than he is. I'm a lot more settled down and stable, and his life is anything but stable. However, he does have a lot of cool things going for him. He got the PhD in literature that, you know, I only thought about, and he's fluent in Spanish, which I am not, and he's way better at martial arts than I am. So he definitely is wish fulfillment, and Percy Jackson, too. One of the neat things about creating characters like that is they always have the perfect thing to say at the perfect time. You know, the rest of us, we think about what we would have said or what we should have said in a conversation. Well, when you're writing it, you can always have the perfect line at just the right time.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Rick Riordan. Again, he is the author of the best-selling children's book series, fantasy series for kids, Percy Jackson and the Olympians. And the last book in that series will be published in May. He's also written a mystery series for adults about this detective Trace Noir. And you can look for both those books in the library and the bookstore. And he will be here in our area. He'll be giving a talk at the Champaign Public Library March 9th. That's all. All the tickets for that have been spoken for, but he'll be doing a signing before and after. And people are welcome to stop by the library and meet him and say hi. Questions also are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Well, I want you to also ask you about a new project that you're involved in. This is the 39 Clues.
Right.
What's that about?
The 39 Clues is a series of 10 books that is being published by Scholastic. It's a very different sort of project for me. Basically, Scholastic, the editors, called me up one day and said, we have this idea, but we don't have anyone to write it. Would you be interested? And when they described the idea to me, I got very excited because it deals with world history. And the object of the books is to sort of present world history in a fun, engaging way to students so that they're learning without even realize that they're learning. And that's always what I wanted to do with Greek mythology. And as a social studies teacher, that appealed to me. The basic premise of the story is that two children, Amy and Dan Cahill, realize that they're part of this enormous family, the Cahill family, and that every major historical figure over the last 500 years has probably been secretly a member of the Cahill clan. And they have to go across the world looking for 39 clues that lead to the secret of the family's power. So it becomes a huge scavenger hunt between different branches of the Cahill family looking for these clues. And the other neat thing about the 39 clues is that it's an attempt to tell a story from many different points of view and in a multi-platform, multimedia way. So there are 10 books, and you can read them simply as a series of books, and that's fine. But for kids who are interested in, say, online gaming, there's a 39 Clues website where you can create your own identity and become a member of the Cahill family and have your own storyline on the online game. And they also have trading cards. Not all kids are into that, but, you know, having two boys, mine certainly are. And that was a big selling point for them, to get them into the story. So there's a lot of different ways to get into the 39 Clues storyline.
Yeah. I think this is interesting, particularly the online tie-in. And at the same time, I expect that there are some people who maybe, having heard that part, are going to start grumbling. And they're going to say, okay, here we go. You know, kids are so... We're sort of consumed with screens and screen time, and we're worried about their screen time. And on the one hand, we're saying reading is great, an actual paper book, you know, that you sit down and you hold in your lap, you take to bed with you, you read with a flashlight under the covers, you know, all that kind of stuff that all of us did.
Right.
That's a great thing. But then they're going to say, but, now you're promoting time in front of the screen. I expect some people would say, whoa, wait a minute, I'm not sure that that's such a good thing.
Yeah, I have heard that definitely, and I am a great advocate for old-fashioned paper books. However, I will say that kids approach this issue completely differently than adults do. They do not see a dichotomy between reading on the internet and reading a book. It's the same thing for them. They read in a different way, and they move between media much more fluidly and much more easily than adults often do. I am on the side that reading is reading, and if it's reading on the internet, if it's reading on your Kindle, if it's reading on your e-reader or your iPhone, that's still reading. I don't have any problem with that. And if there are students who are more comfortable reading online or more comfortable being on the computer, and they are on the computer all the time, we know that from statistics, and if that gets them from the online game into books, well, then I think that's all to the good.
This, you're now getting into what I think is a very interesting area. It seems like there's been a little bit more attention to this lately, and I think that there will be more and more as we think about, as writers, publishers, people who look at technology, people who look at popular culture, everything else, are looking at and thinking about the slow but now rapidly increasing growth of some kind of electronic device that people will use to read, as compared with the traditional book. And that for a long time it seemed like we weren't really quite sure how that would work, whether people would like these things, how reader-friendly they were, are they anything like reading a book, and so forth. And, of course, there are questions for writers and their rights issues and all this kind of stuff. But it seems like we're starting to move more and more into the direction, at least people are saying, well, why not? Yeah, and why not if we could get a good handheld electronic book? Well, why not? And people are starting to get interested. And from that, then you get to the idea of, would people actually read a book on their BlackBerry or on their iPhone? I don't think I would want to do that. But for people who have no problem with reading off a screen, to them it's like, well, sure, you know, why not? As a writer, what do you think about how this whole area is likely to grow?
I think anyone's guess at this point, but I think we are heading into an age where the model for what a book looks like will be much wider and much more varied than we've seen in the past. I certainly hope that the old-fashioned paper book never goes away, because that's how I like to read, and I think of reading as a tactile experience. I want to hold the book in my hands. At the same time, I do read a lot online. I do read from a screen constantly. That's the way I write. I write on a computer. I don't do it by hand. And so I think that that's fine. I think as long as there are choices and people have many different options for reading books, then that's great. But it is the entire industry is heading for an upheaval, I think, that can only be compared to the upheaval the music industry has gone through, from LPs to CDs and now finally to digital music.
Yeah, and that, I suppose, that is the parallel, and that people have looked at how the record industry, the recording industry, responded or didn't respond to the move in this direction, and that they really, several places, dropped the ball. And I suppose now the question is, well, will publishers make the same mistakes, or, you know, will they learn to ride the wave, or will they get pulled under in the way that the recording industry clearly did?
Well, I think the editors that I know are keenly aware of what happened in the recording industry and are very interested in not having that repeat itself in publishing. So we'll have to see what happens, but it's going to be an interesting decade.
Do you, and I wonder, this is maybe a writer-publisher kind of question, but I wonder, as a writer, do you, and as you talk to other writers, have concerns about, with this proliferation of platforms and perhaps people using all these various kinds of devices and different sort of people distributing them, are there going to be issues here, getting to the question, will writers be fairly compensated for their work we have all these new ways of distributing and reading the work?
It's very true, and it's certainly on the mind of most writers I know, and it's every writer's nightmare that their manuscript will appear in digital form freely on the internet before it's ready. And in fact, that happened to Stephanie Meyer recently with a manuscript that she wasn't ready to release, and it caused a huge furor because suddenly it was out in the world for anyone to read, and she was quite embarrassed and mortified that this manuscript was there. So yes, it's on everyone's mind, and we hope that that'll be addressed in a fair way, both for the consumers and for the writers. So we'll have to see.
I know that you still do a lot of school visits, and I think I have mentioned at least once or twice that when you're here, you're going to be spending some time in school talking to kids. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you miss? Do you we talked earlier about the fact that you had been a teacher, and now you're fortunate. You're one of those writers who is fortunate enough actually to make a living off writing,
right.
and not that many do. So you left teaching to be a writer full time. Is that something that you miss?
Oh, very much so. I love working with kids, and the neat thing about being a children's writer is that I still get to be a teacher in a sense. It's just that now my classroom has several million kids in it rather than 30 or 40, and I get to go all over the country, see schools everywhere, talk to kids all the time. So that helps. I feel like I'm still a teacher. But I do miss having my own classroom and seeing the same kids and knowing their names and going through the year with them. Yes, I think that will always be something that I miss. Grading papers, going to faculty meetings, well, not so much. I don't miss that quite as much. Yeah. But I always enjoy working with kids.
I wonder, since you're doing different things and you have done the mystery writing for adults and you have done the writing for children, and you've got the series that's now finished, but you're going on some other projects that are still aimed at kids. Do you structure your time in the sense that you're doing these different sorts of things, you're speaking to different audiences? How do you do that, or do you really even worry about that?
Well, it's a great question. If I ever figure that out, I'll let you know. I go day to day, honestly. I try to get a couple of hours done in the day of writing, but that could be in the morning, that could be in the evening, that could be sitting in an airport. I do all my writing on a laptop, so I'm fairly flexible in terms of where I can work. And when I'm home, obviously, I get a lot more writing done. But it's a balancing act because on one hand, I want to create the stories, and on the other hand, I want to make sure that I'm in touch with the people I'm writing for, which is young adults. And if I'm not out there talking to them and making sure that the stories resonate for them, I don't want to lose my sense for what my audience is looking for.
You also intend that at some point there will be an end to the Tres Navar series?
I think so. I think it will probably be an open-ended ending, as you were talking about earlier. I think I'll let him ride off into the sunset with endless possibilities ahead of him. But there's one more book under contract that I'm working on now, and after that, I don't know. I probably will let him take a sabbatical for a while, and never say never. I may come back to him at some point, but I don't foresee that in the short term.
And would you, after that, do you think that you would do more writing for adults, or do you think that you would rather like to have your focus be the young adult reader?
Well, certainly the children's books are keeping me very busy at the present time, and I have lots and lots of ideas for that. But I'm not going to close the door on writing for adults. If the perfect idea comes to me, I will definitely pursue that. That's the most important thing, I think, for a writer, is that you feel very passionately about what you're writing. And as long as that is true for me, I'll keep producing the novels.
Well, we're going to have to finish now at this point. Again, if you'd like to read some of the work of our guest, Rick Riordan, and by the way, his last name spelled R-I-O-R-D-A-N, Riordan is how he pronounces it. You can look for the detective series, the Tres Navar series, starting with Big Red Tequila. That's the first and the most recent, Rebel Island. There's the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series. First, The Lightning Thief, and the last in the series to be published in May, The Last Olympian. He's got some new books going, the 39 Clues series. So head out to the bookstore or the library. Our guest, Rick Riordan, will be at the Champaign Public Library to give a talk March 9th. All the tickets for this have been spoken for, but we're told that he'll be signing books before and after. And if you'd like to stop by, say hi, meet him, have a book signed, you can do that either between 6 and 6:45. Or afterwards between 8 and 8:45. And Rick, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Support for our program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're going to break, as we usually do at this point. When we come back, we'll be talking about the Illinois economy with two economists from the University of Illinois, Fred Gertz and Richard Dye. First, though, we'll bring you news, an update on the markets. Please stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Hi, this is AM 580 Agriculture Director Dave Dickey. Join us at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana on March 10th for the 2009 All-Day Agriculture Outlook Meeting. Full details are on our website at willag.org. Thanks to these agribusinesses for helping to support this year's meeting: the Andersons, DTN, AgriGold Hybrids, ADM Investment Services, and L&M Commodities. And at mid-session, as we look at the screen, we're seeing very mixed results pretty much all across the commodity picks. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. In Kansas City, March wheat at 566.5 is up a half. May, 573.25, down 3/4. At the Board of Trade, March wheat, 524.75, unchanged. May, 535.75, unchanged. July, 546.5, down 1. September, 572, up a quarter. March corn, 363.75, unchanged. May, 372.25, unchanged. July, 382, unchanged.